When everyone's on the same page, getting things done at work is easy. Make a bigger impact at work with Grammarly. Grammarly is your secure AI writing partner that allows your team to make their point and move faster. You can even save time by going from spending hours editing drafts to just seconds. Join the 96% of Grammarly users that say it helps them craft more impactful writing. Sign up and download Grammarly for free at grammarly.com/podcast. That's grammarly.com/podcast. Easier said. Done.
A change of seasons means adventures in rain, shine, mist, or snow, or all of the above on the same day. This season, prepare for every season with the Allbirds Mizzle Collection. With all-condition traction and materials and features to keep you comfy and dry no matter what, you'll be ready for anything. Go to allbirds.com and use code FRESHSOCKS for a free pair of socks with your purchase. ALLBIRDS.com, code Fresh Socks.
Good afternoon, good morning, good evening, wherever you are in the world. I'm Russell Tovey.
And I'm Robert Diamond.
And this is Talkart.
Welcome to Talkart.
How are you, Rob?
I'm feeling really proud.
Why are you feeling proud, Rob?
Proud to be myself.
Oh.
Which is a gay man. And today's guests have inspired me very much, and I feel like their work gives me a lot of strength. And it's also made me think a lot about my teenage years growing up, especially going to like gay clubs in Reading when I went to school in that area in Berkshire. And yeah, I've been following their work for a number of years, and you yourself got really passionately into their work.
Big time.
And
I'm their biggest fan, I think.
I think you are, actually.
I actually am.
Yeah,
I think the same for me, from my experience in Essex growing up gay. I think I am relating to this work a lot as well, and my journey, my story, and what that is now.
Definitely. So we would like to welcome
Hannah Quinlan
and Rosie Hastings.
Hey.
Hello.
Hi, guys.
God, you guys have that down.
Fantastic introduction.
Oh, we're just so excited to have you here.
Thank you. Oh, your tea's coming in now. Yay. Look at that.
Chamomile tea to calm
nerves. So you're feeling quite nervous?
A little bit. We've never done a podcast before.
You've done a lot of interviews, haven't you?
Yeah, we've done a lot of interviews and a lot of public speaking.
You do public speaking as well?
Yeah, a few lectures every now and again.
Do you like doing interviews and lectures?
I do, but...
Yeah, this is different though, because I guess it's like recorded. When we've done interviews, it's normally been you have like a back and forth with the person who's written the piece.
Yeah.
So there is room for small changes.
Yes, an edit.
Yes.
But no, we can edit this. We're not going to say anything.
We've just been doing a magazine called Hunger with a photographer called Rankin, and we interviewed lots of different artists like Emma Abassia Khan, Haroon Mirza, Zoe Bedeau, Hans Ulrich Obrist, like different people for the magazine. And it was really interesting in the whole editing process and how they gave us back their edits of what they wanted to actually put in the magazine. Yeah. And then we're putting the full interview out on our podcast series. Mm. But it's quite interesting the edit they do. And you have to be really careful and read it through, because they sometimes also when they do audio transcriptions, they totally get the words wrong.
Oh, no.
And it's really quite funny. So you have to like make sure you get it accurate, because otherwise
it's controlling editors. I think that's why we're nervous as well, because when it comes to an interview, we're like, okay, we're going to completely rewrite this now. But with this, it's like, you know.
Do you feel like that, so as editors with your own work, so say like, let's talk about your biggest work today is at Gay Bar, which is where you've been documenting, I think there's 100 queer spaces.
Yeah, so that's called the UK Gay Bar Directory.
Got it.
So the UK Gay Bar Directory is a moving image archive of gay bars in the UK that we made in 2016. Mm-hmm. So we travelled around the UK, went to 14 different cities, and I think we filmed, it was over 100 gay bars.
It was like over 100,
I can't remember how many
spaces,
exactly.
Like, so many spaces. We've said wildly different numbers to different people. Yeah. Been up to 200, but we made a list of 200 bars, and then through going out to different cities, I think there was about 50 that ended up getting cut off that list that had literally been closed since.
But you'd seen them on the internet, you'd gone to the space, and it just wasn't there anymore.
It was all a bit ad hoc. Like, we turn up and we'd kind of have to radically rearrange our plan every time we got to a city, because there was just, it was such a time of like change that, you know, you never really knew what to expect when you arrive somewhere.
Yeah.
And even if the bar hadn't closed, some of the bars were only open on the weekends, or like even one night a week. Some bars were doing that as a way of
a gay night that would happen.
Oh, no, they were like permanent gay venues, but as a way of not having to close, they would just start to open like one night a week to lower the costs.
Really?
So, yeah.
And so you never did you set rules for yourself? So you'd never ring ahead and be like, hi guys, we're coming up, can we film here? Or would you sort of just turn up there and be like, this is what we're doing?
Yeah, we tried that from the beginning, but gay bars have like a famous lack of management structure, apparently. Yeah. That just like,
nightmare.
And you've got proof of that because you've done over 100.
Yeah. There's no one to call. Nightmare. And if you do call someone, they never think it's their job to give you permission. And then some of the bars are run by huge chains in which it seems like you can never get to the person who's allowed to give you permission to film the bar.
Wow. Yeah, we went a bit undercover. I think most people thought we were like secondary school students doing a project on gay bars. I honestly think that.
Yeah. I mean, we were 24 at the time, so we were super young, but I think people thought we were literally like 14 and like, I don't know what they thought.
But that's
we were
quite
doing.
Interesting because I also think not many people have actually gone in and done this kind of work before.
Never.
To like evaluate it and critically look at the whole structures that, you know, have been built up as the gay kind of...
As a social commentary as well, is it? Yeah.
And as bars. And especially when I was growing up, I remember thinking that if you'd go to a gay bar and then... my friends that were women would come along with me, and then often like guys would be quite like, why are they here or something, and it's really upset me. And then when I was in my band, I started out doing gigs in all the gay clubs. That was like how it started, like the Cock, Nag Nag Nag, Ghetto, like those kind of things, Electrogogo, all these kind of club nights. And in those environments it was very different because women were really included, because you had like Princess Julia, or you had Anna Mantronic, or you had all these different kind of female singers as well that would come in and perform live. So in London, I felt like it was slightly different. But then you did have that whole kind of XXL club where like women weren't even allowed in. And I always had a real problem with that because I felt like it was just sort of...
And that's just gone. That's literally just closed down, XXL.
Has it really? It?
Yep.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, yeah. XXL's just gone. Just gone. They've turned that venue into... Look at you. You are so upset
now.
No,
I'm not upset. I'm just shocked.
Yeah, gone.
That's so interesting because all the gay clubs, I feel like, are getting shut down. Like there's none left anymore.
But this is what your work is about, isn't it? This is what you're documenting.
Yeah. Especially with that project, it was, I think... When we started filming 2015, 2016, it was a particularly bad time for closures. Like you had the Black Cat closed
In Camden,
And oh my God,
Join His Arms,
that George was a big one, George and the Dragon. Yeah, all of these big historical venues seemed to be closing, and it was really in response to that. And then we started doing it actually in Newcastle, where Hannah's from, and I think going out of London, going to gay bars out of London, seeing kind of what was happening, it showed us that there was a kind of real diversity of reasons why gay bars were closing, and it was kind of different, there was geo specific reasons why this was happening. And I think that's what drew us into
that. Was
it
the obsession
became our obsession, kind of understand what was going on and connecting all these sort of moments in time, and you know, to create this bigger picture of the sort of UK. And and that was a time as well, like during Brexit, it was like the beginning of sort of Brexit, so the beginning of the Brexit vote, and there's this real sort of social and political upheaval. And I think that was very much something that was being lived through in the gay bars. It was just...
And you come up against a lot of people reluctant to let you into the bar as you're female.
It was a nightmare, honestly, being snuck into sex clubs at 9 a.m. and sort of begging to be let into all male clubs and being turned away. And it just became this real conflict in the work. On one hand, we were trying to create an archive, and on the other hand, we were really angry and pissed off because there was part of us that wanted to, you know, celebrate this culture.
Yeah.
But at the same time,
you're being told you're not allowed.
We've been completely rejected by it, and it's so frustrating. We're putting, you know, we were on the road for like 9 months, and it was just really hard. And it became... That became like an important tension.
Was it just you two with a video camera?
It was just us two with a GoPro camera, so like a tiny, tiny camera, which I think, I don't know if we made that choice consciously at the beginning, but it became, I think it would have been the only way we could have actually filmed the directory, because going into these bars with anything larger than that would have just been completely impractical in terms of like just gaining access, gaining permission to film. As Rosie said, quite often you weren't able to like get official permission, so you had to kind of do it on the sly.
It also would have felt a bit voyeuristic, I think. Like we were keen to just sort of slip in.
And it's the space. There's nobody in the space. It's these spaces that the queer people and allies occupy. So you're documenting them. Yeah. So it's that kind of spirit in there of what is to be, the kind of excitement of when you walk into a gay bar when there's no one there.
Mm-hmm. Just we're really interested as well, because when we first started working together, we started off by building gay bars. Like, we built one in our bedroom, we built one in our studio. We built
what do you mean you built a gay bar? Like, what did that involve?
I never knew that.
Yeah, really? A disco
honestly,
ball.
Wow,
you don't even know. We would build like the booths. So like we would upholster like huge, big booths, like sitting booths, and then get all the buy tables like secondhand online, and then get all the stainless steel bar furniture.
Got, in, like, in your flat?
In our, well, we
no, lived, we weren't living in like a
we were
flat.
Living in a studio. We were running and like living in a studio building on Murray Lane in Peckham, which was amazing. Like we moved there when we just graduated, and we were paying like £100 a month rent. We had two studios, huge bedroom. It was like the complete fantasy of being a young artist with all this space. And so we said, let's build a gay bar and start running a gay bar, because that's kind of what we were interested in. And it was, we saw it as this kind of opportunity to create a space that could critically look at the mainstream gay bar scene and sort of socialise some of the ideas in queer theory we're thinking about, and create a more community-facing kind of space. Mm. So we started doing these one-night events, and it was so crazy. We spent all month building it, and we got really obsessive about all the little details.
We had actual glasses, not plastic glasses, which is
wow,
it's very important.
Which is rare even in real gay bars. I don't know why we did that. Stupid.
We made like these huge light boxes. We showed video work, and it was kind of, we learned how to do absolutely everything.
How long did you do this for?
I think that was
like 4 years.
4 years?
Yeah, ages. Yeah.
Once a month for 4 years.
No, not once a month.
We did like two or three a year. And then the last one we did was right after we finished UK Gay Bar Directory. And I think we had this weird idea then that, because we saw ourselves as part of more of this like sort of grassroots, almost like act, you know, we didn't see ourselves as really artists. We saw ourselves more as a kind of activist or like community organizers.
Right.
And so we got commissioned to make the Gay Bar Directory by Somerset House, and straight, it was during the opening of the show, we organised this month-long at Gay Bar kind of event and space where we programmed a different thing every single night. And I think we saw it as sort of anecdotal to working with Somerset House and sort of anecdotal to working with the institution. But it was just so, I think that was the one that was really the nail in the coffin, because it was so hard. We did it for a month. Yeah. We were working day jobs.
Well, we would always build bars with like a real sense of permanence, as if they didn't feel like a one night only event. Mm. They felt very much like a permanent space.
But did you live in them when they weren't being used by like customers?
Yeah.
Did you use them in your house?
Well, we would just build them for one night and then dismantle them.
You would?
Yeah.
We
would spend about 3 weeks building it and then take it down.
So financially, this was being supported by Somerset House as an ongoing
thing? No.
This was being supported
by just us.
Hannah worked at the Peck and Pelican, and worked at the British Museum.
So that's a bar where it's kind of like Camberwell, opposite South London Gallery.
Yes.
So it's kind of ridiculous. I was working in the bar, and then I would finish my shift, and then I would go to our bar for the two weeks we had it open. So this was the first time we had opened a bar for longer than one night. I think it was just the act of having to... I think we just experienced how hard it is to run a gay venue.
Yeah,
maybe.
Wow.
All the associated drama.
Did you have like
drama.
Doorman and stuff like that, or how did you? How did you keep it safe?
We had someone on the door. We didn't have.
It was very illegal.
We didn't have security. We had. We did pay someone to be on the door, but they weren't. I mean, no, Susie was a bouncer at that time.
She was actually an officiated bouncer. Yeah,
we had a bouncer.
We had a few people on the door, but it's very much you knock on the door, you get let in. There's no windows. It was boiling hot. There was a huge wind machine. Everyone was sort of smoking in there, being naughty. And we did get raided by the police a few times.
You did?
Yeah. For some reason, they never took it further, which I don't understand, because they came in. We were like, it's a private party. And then they came up and they just saw like all this money behind the bar. And...
So did you make money from doing it as well?
Oh my God, we lost so much money.
Oh, you lost money?
No, honestly, we always lost money, but you did. You made enough money to like...
keep running
to
it.
Do
that's
it.
All we wanted, that's all we cared about.
Wow.
Yeah.
So, and did you see it as like a performance art as well?
Yeah,
it definitely started off as kind of like a container in which to put our, like, as Rosie said, like socialized ideas around queer theory. And like we were making videos for the bars, and the first time we showed the UK Gay Bar Directory was in the installation, so we had it shown on a screen inside of the bar,
behind the bar. Yeah. And then
And it's 5 hours long, isn't it?
What, the Gay Bar Directory?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's 4
and
a half hours long.
It's written places that it's an ongoing thing, but you've finished that now. That project is done.
I don't, oh, There is part of me that would just love to get back on the road, because I feel like...
Because half of them are probably gone again, haven't they?
They're probably gone. There's probably some new ones, but also just those conversations we had, the photos we took, the material we collected. It really was... That Gay Bar Directory and the At Gay Bar project were both completely foundational to our practice, and it's something that we're still drawing on. Like, for instance, our most recent film, Something for the Boys, that we shot last year, that was set in this incredible venue in Blackpool, called Funny Girls, which is like an Art Deco cabaret.
And this was at Kiss My Genders at the Hayward Gallery recently.
Yeah.
Yes.
And that was all because of the Gay Bar Director. We went to Blackpool, we found this, you know...
What's amazing about that is that now you're talking about building the gay bar yourself, is that is an actual installation where you feel like you're walking into this kind of lounge of a gay club with these faux velveteen curtains that are ruched going in. Yeah. So it's an immersive experience, which is actually an amazing way to see video art, parenthesis, isn't it? What an incredible... thing to do. I love that.
And I think that the way that installation, like, it was because when we were talking to the curator Vincent, he actually commissioned us to do an At Gay Bar event at the David Roberts when he was still working there as a director, and I think he had that's
a
vision
foundation,
in his mind.
David Roberts is a big collector and supports, and
they really supported us in our early career.
Wow.
But I think he had that At Gay Bar sort of installation in mind, and he said, you know, I want it to be spectacular, and it really drew those qualities out, I think.
Mm-hmm. So what is it like making work together? Because you are a couple.
Yeah.
And you're in love.
So in love.
Oh!
It's amazing how much you travel. Like, I feel like you're kind of constantly on the road like a band or something. It's brilliant. No. But like, you're obviously... You're,
like Shakespeare's sister.
But I know from experience that when you travel, even with like your best friends or your lovers or whatever...
Oh God, me and Rob, like, best mates, he does my head in.
And what about this way? You do
perfect,
my head in too.
I'm perfect.
No, but... I know how intense it can be, especially when you're like exhausted from traveling or all that kind of thing. So what's it been like for you to be on this journey together? It must be incredible.
And you met a training as well, like at school.
Yeah, we met at Goldsmiths.
Yeah, I don't know. It's been so easy. It feels like it was difficult at the beginning because you have to like get rid of your ego about authorship and the idea of like talent and skill and like who's from who and like who's bit of the work that is and whose bit of the work is Rosie's and whose is mine, and you kind of lose all of that. But I think most artists do work collaboratively, and I think it's just with us that we're both named. But everyone I know kind of, they'll work with assistants or they'll collaborate with people, and I think
of people like Christo, and for years it was just Christo, and then she had her name added, Jean-Claude. But she didn't for the first, I don't know, 15 years of their career.
Yeah.
But you two have started from the beginning.
Yeah.
I mean, and also, like, how do you work out what your medium is? Because I'm talking about the drawings especially, which I love.
I love your drawings.
Oh my God,
amazing.
I love your drawings.
No, they're so, so amazing.
But you make them together.
Yeah.
And you're saying about which bit of which work is whose and whose. How do you delegate these big scale drawings that you do?
We're figuring it out.
But I think again with this, it's like, I think people who've made drawings, I mean, like, if you think of like old masters, Renaissance style, they've always worked with like a studio of assistants, and they've worked on different parts of the drawing, and then the assistants have done sketches for the composition, and then it's all been come together. I think we're both basically orchestrating the drawing, and there is moments in which you'll delegate certain tasks to someone.
Yeah, we sort of take it in turns to be the boss or the assistant.
Wow.
But I think it's quite a traditional way of working.
Within each drawing, it kind of...
Yeah, yeah. So for instance, like, one of us will be working the composition. We'll be like, okay, you go and figure out the colour palette. And then we'll swap over and someone will be drawing all the faces, and it's really intense.
And the faces are you, a lot of them. Because just acquired a drawing called The Sleepers from Arcadia. From PPOW Gallery.
Was that the one at Freeze?
Yeah.
You got that one?
Yeah.
I didn't know you bought it.
Yes.
That's hilarious. I actually posted it on my Instagram, but I didn't even know you'd bought
it. Mine, yeah.
That's
I was just about to say that. I spent ages on PPOW's booth, standing in front of your work. And obviously, I was incredibly busy because I had my own booth there. But I actually made time to go and look at it because I'd seen it on Instagram. And I was like, I have to see this in real life.
Yeah.
And it's the most beautiful work. And I can't believe I'm going to get to see more of it. You own it.
Yeah, well, not for a while, because I think it's staying in the States and possibly being used somewhere else. But
that's great.
The faces in it are your, I got told, was your face. Rosie's the model.
I mean, it's a mashup.
my brother actually came to me and he got sucked into the drawing as well, which is funny.
No, I think we sketch out the composition without any references, and then from that point you're like, shit, I don't know how to draw this, I need a photo. So we'll like take, obviously it's normally just me and Rosie in the studio, so we'll end up taking pictures of each other and doing just to get details for the pose, even though the people often end up looking very different.
Yeah, like obviously some of them are men and stuff, so but it's useful to have that kind of foundation. Often we just end up using each other, but it's funny, we have got a few drawings where you can very specifically see that it's me or Hannah, and it's just
really
I think it's something quite nice about it's quite nice that we're in the work like that. But yeah, I'm so happy that you got the sleepers.
Oh, I love it.
And that was a lot of love went
Edward
into Byrne that
Jones
has
which before I mean he was peripheral.
Not even that into Edward Byrne Jones. I'm
these
not
images
that,
like, he did a Dreamers sequence, didn't he?
He did the Briar Rose series. That's which is based on the Sleeping Beauty story. I mean, we honestly nothing to do with Edward Byrne Jones. Go to Tate and we just get started having this conversation, because I mean, I'm sure like a lot of art historians will disagree with me about this, but we were just interested in how sort of the way that the Tate presented Edward Byrne Jones was with this sort of presentation of it being slightly queer and slightly feminist, because he has all these
fluidity
sort of,
and
he's got these gender fluid characters and that who are very androgynous. But on the other hand, we were interested in the fact the way that he sort of constructs these sort of nationalistic myths about these sort of origin stories, British origin stories. And it felt very significant that the show opened at the time of sort of upheaval where origin stories in the UK are being sort of contested. And we're thinking about how his images sort of could sort of get absorbed into narratives that have been used by white nationalists.
It was very much like
ultra-conservative.
Like an aesthetic of queer white androgyny as a cover-up for white supremacy.
We got in deep. That's why we got into Edward Byrne Jones. And then also just, I think it was just that room where the Briar Rose series was. He has four of them. And just, we loved that, how intense it was. Just being there, spinning around, looking at all the paintings. We thought, wow, imagine if we did that. But we only did one in the end.
How long did they take, these drawings?
So that the sleepers took 2.5 months.
Wow. Oh, my God. And you did this in Barcelona.
They are so detailed, though.
I know. This
it's
is
very
10
slow.
10 hours a day. 6 days a week.
So does it drive you? Can you still look at the work and be like, "Oh, I remember that bit, and I'm doing that." And
you go through phases of absolutely detesting a drawing, and then suddenly you're like, "It's amazing."
I know.
And then you're like,
"Never each other."
No,
never get wound up with each other.
Oh, of course.
Oh, okay.
The fights, the slamming doors, the storming out, the tears. Like, you really drawing is the most existential thing you can do. You are on this journey and it's so emotionally intense, and I don't know why it is. It's not like this with any other medium.
I know.
But you just,
it's really weird.
It's because you have to be so
you'll
confident.
You'll get so worked up, and then it's like, all we're doing is drawing a picture. Yeah. Like, can we just calm down?
That's amazing.
But this is a massive part of your practice, drawing, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, we actually started drawing after we filmed the Gay Bar Directory, and I think...
Yeah, so it's only been, what, like 2.5 years drawing?
But were you drawing when you were younger as well?
I drew a lot.
Yeah, I did draw.
Yeah.
But it was more... This was more like, we were like, we're quite intense. Like, we're like, oh, we want to do something. Let's learn. We want to be like a Renaissance master, and we'll get really obsessed. We're like, we want to be like Michelangelo. We get and like, the amount of times we've like been really upset because we're like, we're just not as good as him. Like,
it's Michelangelo.
Yeah.
I
know.
That's great,
like, I'll come to Rosie with these sob stories, being like, oh, I just feel like I'm never going to be as good as Michelangelo.
We have to like go for a walk.
She's like, shut up. Like, why are you getting upset about this?
Oh my God, I would love to be like a camera on the wall listening to these conversations.
It's so ridiculous.
That is so genius.
Our lives is honestly ridiculous.
But that's an amazing way of getting into the work. Is obviously respecting art history and what's come before, and then carrying on
and
that
also
conversation.
Striving for greatness.
Yeah.
I feel like that's really...
But that's what George Kondo did, didn't he? He set out and said, look at the great masters, look at the Picassos and everything, and why are they doing that? And I want to understand that, so I'm going to paint like them and then continue the conversation.
And actually, we met Alvaro Barrington yesterday, and I heard him talk about before this idea that people often think someone like Jean-Michel Basquiat or Warhol, all these people, are like superhuman, that they're from another planet, but in fact, they're just humans, and they are just like you and me, and that anything is possible, and we all can do whatever we want to
do. That's what I feel. Everyone's like, oh, you're so good, and I'm like, no, I'm actually really bad. I'm not naturally good at drawing. Like, we actually have watched YouTube videos and like gotten books for children, and we've gone to life drawing like for 2 years now, and you build it up like any talent.
Also, I read about Michelangelo recently, which really put my Michelangelo worries to bed, that he actually burned a huge amount of his preparatory drawings because he didn't want anyone to see them.
So
he destroyed a huge amount of his work, and he only wanted the final pieces to be left intact so that obviously it would retain this myth of him
that's
being
so this cool. God.
So they were aware at the time that they wanted to come across as this perfect.
Yeah.
Icons.
Perfect. So now yeah. I know.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, this is Russell Tovey and Robert Diamond from Talk Arts, the arts podcast, and we're here today with Budweiser beer, and we're going to be talking about something very, very important to both of us, aren't we, Rob?
That's right. Budweiser, the king of beers, has joined forces with legendary artist Sir Peter Blake, the godfather of British pop art and someone that both of us have adored since we were kids.
I've loved pop art since I was a kid, and Sir Peter Blake has been a constant for me, alongside other pop art artists, the Americans like Andy Warhol, Roy Lichtenstein, Keith Haring. And I got into pop art, Rob, because I loved cartoons growing up. I mean, I still love animation. But suddenly I discovered that so many artists were referencing comic strips and cartoons in their artworks, and I could go and see them in museums, and I suddenly didn't need to grow up. And Sir Peter Blake was one of these artists that meant so much to me. And I think people, if they don't know the name Sir Peter Blake, you would certainly know his work. The album cover for The Beatles, Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club, Oasis's Stop the Clocks. These are iconic art historical moments that this artist has actually been at the forefront of.
And you've met him, haven't you?
I've met him, yeah, at the South Bank Show Awards years ago. I was there for the History Boys, and he was there, and I got incredibly excited and met him. But you've not met him before, have you, Rob?
I have. I've actually even been to his house and hung out with him and his wife, and I got to make an amazing print with him, which was a huge privilege, actually. It was a real career moment for me. So Budweiser and Sir Peter Blake have come together to unite, and they have created an exclusive limited edition beer can, which doubles as a collectible piece of pop art.
And it was on display at London's Truerman Brewery on the 23rd and 24th of March this year, if you were lucky enough to get there. And also, were you one of the lucky few that were able to get one of the signed beer cans by Sir Peter Blake himself? And there was something very special there, wasn't there, Rob? What was that?
They've actually made the first ever fridge frame, which kind of is reminiscent of what we would be, you know, accustomed with in terms of a museum exhibit. Yeah. But this fridge frame is designed to display the limited edition can of beer as a work of art, but also keeps the beer cool.
Okay, I need a fridge full of fridge frames because this sounds incredible. So Peter Blake's work adorns the cans with all of his eye-catching simplicity. It features the Budweiser's iconic red bow tie logo, but it's encompassed by the artist's signature and his use of block colours and icons. They unveiled this artistic can in all of its glory in one of these fridge frames, as Rob said, which is very exciting. The limited edition cans are available to purchase as a four-pack for a limited time only in selected Tesco stores nationwide.
Budweiser and Sir Peter Blake, thank you for bringing us this cultural moment. I love it when art reaches new audiences, and I really feel like this is going to go into everyone's homes, and is really joyous. So head over to Tesco, pick up a four-pack. Thank you, Budweiser.
But also, if you want to get this collectible piece of art at home, Budweiser also giving people the chance to own their very own exclusive fridge frame. Beer and art lovers can register their interest by visiting www.budweiser.co.uk/Sir Peter Blake collab. That's budweiser.co.uk/Sir Peter Blake collab. Budweiser and Talk Art with Sir Peter Blake.
Yeah. And for the work that Russell got from Freeze, when did you know it was finished? Like, how do you say this is finally finished? Have you been working that intensely?
Yeah, it's tough. It's like an escalation. It's always a bit of an escalation. Like, you go from this routine, and it all the last week of a drawing, you lose all your shit, and you're it's all you do, it's all you can think about, it's all you can obsess over. And we were colouring things in, rubbing them out, redrawing them, kind of in this get really frantic. And then suddenly it's like you can't go on anymore, and you just are so tired, and you hate it so much, and you just have to pull the plug. And
also, the, you know, it's the deadline as well.
Yeah,
it's a big
and
help.
The deadline.
Without the deadline, you would just go on.
They were like, "You got to have this ready for freeze."
Yeah.
Framed and ready for freeze.
Yeah. The framing deadline. Yeah, that just really helps you be like, "Okay, let's stop."
We did manage to not do any all nighters though, which was nice.
Oh, that's a shame. I was hoping you would have lost sleep over that drawing.
Deadly sleep over.
As it's called, the sleepers.
Don't worry. Okay.
So what's next for you two?
Oh my God. So we have our first ever institutional solo show coming up, which opens at the beginning of February at Focal Point Gallery.
Woo! In Southend in Essex.
Yeah. Woo! We love Southend. We were there yesterday.
Yeah, it's cool, right? That's so exciting.
I know, and we love Catherine Stout, who's the curator.
She's also from Essex.
She's so cool. Yeah.
And we're obsessed with her, and we're so happy to be... She's just like a breath of fresh air.
And she's
so
gone from the ICA, hasn't she? She was at the ICA for a long time. She's
just
great.
Got this like calm energy, which is so like unusual in the art world. Like it's almost like it's not you're not working on a show, you're working... It's just really... I don't know, it's very, it's like very soothing about like, her,
Do you know what you want to do? Have you got ideas?
So next week we're going to a farmhouse in Toulouse to meet this woman, Fleur, and she's going to teach us how to paint frescoes.
No way!
So that is our next skill.
Here we come, Sistine Chapel.
Wow, would that be straight onto the wall there, do you think?
We're trying to figure it out. Like,
it depends on practical...
How long are you going to get to do that, in a month or something? Or
we've got a week... Well, the workshop's a week, and then we come back, and then the install period is only 2 weeks. So we're trying to figure out if, you know, if we might need to paint, get a section of wall and put it in a studio and paint it before, or like if we can do it in the gallery. We're trying to figure it all out. It's very confusing. No one paints frescoes anymore. Like, there's no one. Normally, when we start doing something, you just reach out to our friends and we're like, "How do you do this?" And they tell us. But with this, it's like, no. We're reading like these Renaissance handbooks to like painting frescoes.
We use
like,
gold leaf, do you think, and stuff?
No. I don't think so.
No.
It's a bit tawdry.
That's so interesting though, because it's true, it's a dying art. Yeah. A lot of these like ancient kind of crafts almost or skills are totally dying out. And it is really important to try and keep
it's
it
like
alive.
It's folk art, but, isn't it?
Yeah,
it just
it's
doesn't
crazy.
Seem to exist as much.
Yeah. I don't know what drew us. I think something about the I think it was also that we do drawing and we've always, people have been like, "Okay, when are you going to start painting?" And it's not. If we still just feel a bit weird about oil on canvas, like, I don't think we can go there. And this just feels like it feels a bit sculptural. You know, you're doing the layers of plaster and you've got the pigment and it feels a bit painty and a bit drawy. And it feels like a really, just feels like the perfect happy.
So exciting.
There is also something quite permanent about frescoes, because you think about them, even though they might fall apart a bit, they do seem to sort of last somehow, don't they? If they're cared for, I guess.
We look at ones in churches end up getting plastered over and then like 400 years.
Yeah, then they uncover
them.
Again,
and it's always...
No, I think we were definitely drawn to that idea of like it being permanent within the architecture.
Yeah.
That'd be pretty cool if they did do it like they did churches, covered it up, and then about 500 years they come and take Focal Point apart and they're like, "What is this?
Someone in Paris who, actually my ex-boyfriend in Paris, bought a flat and he was doing all the work and suddenly the architect called him while we were dating and said, "Oh, there's a fresco behind here or something." And they actually took all the plaster off and they found something and it ended up becoming the main feature in his flat.
Oh, wow.
And I'd love to see a picture.
Yeah, and I don't think it was anything super like collectible or whatever it was called, you know, like famous, but it was just something more I don't know, I can't remember what it was now, but it did totally change the way he was doing his apartment.
Wow.
It was like
the
coolest thing.
How
you'd never
you
know
avoid that, could you ignore that?
Yeah, it's so cool.
That's amazing. Have you ever documented queer spaces in Essex?
No, we didn't do Essex. Sad. Oh, we did want to go do Sundowners, and that's in Margate.
Oh, that's in Margate. Yes. Yeah, in Kent.
No, we've got a good friend, Ted, who lives in Margate, who's a dancer. I don't know if you've met him.
Not yet.
He's amazing, and he's promised to give us a good tour of.
Well, you
can join up. We saw Margate Pride looked quite banging this year.
Do you know what? It was really banging, and it was so busy, and it was so happy.
And Mel C was there, wasn't
Mel
she?
Mel C was there, who I love. Whoa. But it was like old school. It felt really like what it was like in 95 or something.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Like it reminded
it
me.
Wasn't
like,
commercialized, was
no,
it
wasn't commercialised. No, it wasn't commercialised at all.
It's just better.
It was so good. honestly. Yeah. It was great. Nice. I'm quite interested in this idea that you both studied at Goldsmiths, and obviously when you're, because you're both still really young in a way, but you've had a lot of institutions kind of start to support the work, like you've done, like Russell said, the Hayward, and then you've had the Whitechapel, and now you've got Focal Point. Do you feel a pressure when you start getting these shows, or does it just feel like almost going to help push you forward in your strength of, you know, believing in yourself or something? Like, how does that feel? Just because I know we have a lot of younger artists listening to the podcast who might not have even gone to university yet or things like that. Like, what's it like actually beginning to exhibit once you've left uni?
I think the opportunities you're given are really, really important to how your work develops and how big you can start to imagine your work becoming. And for us, it was a case of being very, everything was self-initiated and we weren't really getting asked to do anything. So I think we were like building the bars, and then we started to get asked to do stuff. And then depending on kind of like financial support from institutions and just like literally physically how much space they're giving you, it just enables you to like imagine these huge ideas. I think we just encountered that a lot with, we just did a commission with Art Nights, which was a performance art commission. And I think that just allowed us to develop our performance practice in a way that I just wouldn't have even been able to imagine before. So I think,
wow,
yeah, this is with a pride float, yeah. Single pride float,
it was
wasn't
wild,
it?
Yeah,
traveling through. Where was it going through?
Walthamstow. So, yeah. So Art Nights was in Walthamstow this year, and it was curated by Helen Nisbet, who was amazing. And yeah, they said to us, imagine the craziest thing you can think of and we'll make it happen. And no one's ever said that to us before. Normally they're like, you're too crazy, shut up.
Yeah.
Don't do that.
Just stick
do
to
this.
Give us a drawing.
Yeah, give us a nice drawing. And we were like, yes, we can do whatever we want. And so we built a pride flow. We made this hour-long music composition. We
made our own band.
Wow.
Made a film that we showed in this huge stadium screen. It was in public. It was out in the public, which was amazing. So you got like families and like,
so I'm so inspired. You rise to the challenge. You're not scared.
But that's what I'm about to say. Because I feel
no,
like with you two, you have this incredible positivity as well. And like, it's like you're taking these new opportunities and just like going
seizing
for
the day with them.
So good.
Yeah. And I think what you're saying as well about that thing of working with institutions and like the responsibility that comes with it. I think that the beginnings of our practice, we did feel very much like we had this idea that the work we were creating, it was intended as a public resource. Things like the Gay Bar Directory, like it wasn't artwork, but we wanted it to be more than that. We wanted it to be something that people could use for like research or something that could be used in education.
Right.
And so it did partner well with an institution which is a public resource. And I think we've just pursued that throughout our career, and I think that is why now we have ended up doing more institutional stuff.
Right.
And if you want to see this, it's at the Walker Art Gallery in Liverpool.
Yes.
So you can go there whenever you want everything. And see it.
Yeah, because they bought it for the collection, didn't they?
Yeah,
the
and
British
that was
Council,
crazy.
Wasn't it?
That is so brilliant.
The Art Fund, and it was a fund for the Walker to invest. It was, invest in queer art. And that was, we were 24, 25.
Wow, what an endorsement.
And it was just the most validating thing in the world ever. And then the Art Council bought this sculpture that we made called Attitude, which we showed with the Gay Bar Directory.
This is the cork board? No, that wasn't a cork
board. That wasn't the cork board. Oh. Cork board was part of it, and that's what we showed at the Whitechapel. And this Attitude sculpture is a metal wall sculpture that was powder coated, and it was sort of this pride flag with water and clouds and fire.
Oh, I've not seen that.
That was very recently acquired by the Art Council. Wow. And that's been a conversation ongoing since 2016. So that was, it was just amazing. It just blew us away.
Can you explain the corkboard work? Because I find that work really touching, because my memories of growing up are very much like you would see, because when you realise you're gay, well, this is my experience anyway, when I realised I was gay, you sort of try, you're living in a town where maybe you've never really met anyone else, or you might not realise you've met anyone else who's gay. And then you would go to like magazines, say, or when you do eventually go to the gay bar or the gay club, you start seeing images of what's being presented to you as almost like what the gay...
On the cover of the free magazine,
precisely,
like Boys, for example.
Exactly. You start seeing these guys who are often very muscular, or you know, all this thing that
or
I
white.
Wasn't
a lot of
or
white
a lot of white yeah exactly predominantly white actually and so you're being fed this kind of information that you're then trying to align yourself with because you want to belong to something, but it doesn't actually really resonate with you at all because it's not who I was. Do you know what I mean? And I found that corkboard work you made really touching because of that kind of experience that I'd had myself.
Yeah, so with the cork board was basically a collection of leaflets, kind of like posters, free magazines such as Boyzone and Scots Gay. And then there was also an archive of Attitude magazine, which is like a very mainstream UK gay magazine that's been running, I think, since like mid-80s, I want to say, which is kind of famous for having often straight, white, muscular celebrities on the cover.
Prince William.
Yeah, Prince William.
What is that?
Was he actually on the cover of Attitude?
Yeah, shocking.
That I didn't know.
2016, when really? We made the work.
And then there was also loads of adverts for the red arrows in the magazine. It's just very weird.
Weird. It's the formation though, isn't it? That's what we're all
we need to know about the red arrows now.
Weird.
Yes.
It was really weird, actually. Attitude magazine recently featured an image of the corkboard, which on the corkboard there's loads of Attitude magazine covers which we've burnt and ripped up, and then they, like, obviously completely not knowing the content, included an image of this corkboard, and I was like, it's very very strange.
But I think the reason why we were drawn to this ephemera and we started collecting it was because what you're saying, like, gay, I think that's, it's part of that culture of gay bars that makes them truly unique, is that they are, that's part of the way that they form a community, is through this sort of, these leaflets, these flyers, these services that they promote. And and what we were interested in is that although gay bars are, you know, they can be the source of a lot of problems within the community, like of related to like substance abuse, for example, like they're also providing this sort of anecdote to that with
these safe space.
Yeah, a safe space and so this kind of support level of degree of support. Mm. And that's, I don't know, it's something that we really loved the venues we visited.
Yeah, it's a very like messy situation that seems to be unique to gay bars, is that you have venues that sell alcohol at like incredibly low prices. And then they also have a lot of leaflets in that venue kind of advertising support for alcoholics awareness, and
it's part of this wider sort of culture where, like, for instance, I remember going to a bar in Brighton and everyone there was like over the age of 80, and we spoke to the owner and he was like, oh, it's basically like an LGBTQ like old people's home here. And we're like, that's not a service that is offered by Austerity UK.
No.
These venues are becoming a sort of public infrastructure, they have a use. And in Blackpool we went to a bar that opened at 9 a.m. and we were like, why do you open at 9 a.m? That's crazy. And the guy was like, because there's a really big homelessness problem in Blackpool, and I'd rather that the people came here and had somewhere to sit all day in the warm and get really, he was selling drinks at pretty much cost, like you could get a pint for like a pound, and he was like, I'd rather people be in here and we can keep an eye on them. And then after 7 we kicked them out, and it turns, and we put the prices up and turns back into a kind of gay venue.
Wow.
Yeah.
That guy needs an award.
No, I know.
Beautiful. They become
Ian Roche. They become obsessed.
Multi-purpose venues.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's so interesting.
And they...
Ross used to talk a lot about that, about having, when we all got old, like almost like investing in
an
old people's home.
Big retirement home.
Yeah, and but we would all go to it.
There's a charity called Opening Doors, which looks after...
We've done some stuff with Opening
Amazing.
Doors.
Amazing. And Albert Kennedy Trust looks after homeless youth.
Albert Kennedy Trust.
I'm a patron for them. It's like, it's a really important service.
I tried to like volunteer for Opening Doors and they didn't accept me.
Oh,
what do you mean?
Well, I get why, because basically you get a friend and then you go and see them once a week.
Yeah.
But basically, if you've got a weird schedule like us,
same,
and you don't know where you're going to be, you kind of can't do anything.
I did it with Help the Aged. I did all the training, and then I was like, oh, I've got a job for 6 months.
Yeah.
And they're like,
you can't do this anymore.
You've got to see someone every week.
Yeah, because you need the continuity.
Yeah, because they like that for the trust. Anyway, so we ask everyone who comes on two very important questions. The first one, and you know this because you've been listening to Talk Art.
We know we're prep.
Who did you listen to again? You listened to Zadie Shah?
Zadie Cole, Barlow.
Zadie was also in
Art Night,
wasn't she? We love Zadie. Hi, Zadie.
Love Zadie.
Yes.
Zadie, you're a goddess.
And you were listening to Talk Out while you were making the drawing in Barcelona I acquired at Freeze.
Yeah.
That's
yeah.
So
all
weird.
Very meta.
It's
all very meta. Love it. We ask everyone, if you could do an art heist and you have a touchstone artwork that you can steal and live with forever, what would that be?
So we chose very boring early Renaissance painting. We chose Mantenga's Crucifixion.
Wow. Mm.
Very,
that's
I don't
intense.
Know if
what
that
goes
comes
on in that,
to mind.
Then?
It's just the most amazing composition. So it's the three crosses and then there's the Romans, but the Romans are the campest Romans I've ever
they're
seen.
Like gay Romans.
And everyone's wearing pink.
Well, they all were, weren't they?
Yeah, yeah. Such gay Romans.
Very gay. No, it's just an amazing
There's a lot of melodrama. It's very dramatic.
Where did you see this?
Well, we first saw it in Mantenga's book,
which we amended.
And then we went to the Louvre and saw it. Yeah, it's permanent.
So it's three crosses, like all up. There's bodies on the crosses. Yeah. Christ up there.
And then you've got like Mary, like fainting into the arms of the woman. And then you've got the gambling soldiers, and you've got a drunk, and it's just, it's kind of all kicking. It's like the most insane composition.
But it's this really nice perspective that we've. I mean, in Funny Girls, we used the same kind of perspective. So the figures come right up to the edge of the image.
So Funny Girls is a drawing that we were commissioned to make. By the Hayward Gallery.
Yeah.
We also showed it at Frieze.
Yeah. This is the black and white one.
Yeah.
So this is a room, and there's like violence and love and people being worshipped, and it's kind of like, it reminds me of like Orange is the New Black in sections. And
I was actually reading a text about your work, and it said like you often present people, I guess, on the cusp of violence, love or violence.
Yeah.
And I was like, God, that's really intense.
Yeah.
That's dramatic in itself. Yeah. I loved it.
I know. There's a lot of angst.
So can I ask you something? When you saw it in the book and you loved it and you were like obsessing over that work, when you go to the Louvre and you finally see it in real life, what was that like?
It was hell. There was a tourist behind tapping. I was looking at it. I was like, oh my God, this is amazing. I'm finally
trying to have a moment.
And then this like woman was just tapping on my shoulder, get out of the way. I want to take a photo. And I was like, fuck.
Yeah,
so annoying.
That is the pressure of being in the Louvre.
The Louvre is the worst, most stressful place ever, and they shouldn't put their art in there. It's just too
hectic.
These places are crazy. Yeah. Even we went to Tate Britain to see the William Blake, and we were like queuing to see each drawing.
Yeah,
it's not the best way to see art, is it? It becomes stressful when it's
Well, that's good that so many people are actually going out and seeing it. On the other hand,
I also think early morning's often good. If you go really early, sometimes you miss the crowd.
Or right before closing.
Yes, or right before closing. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. So the other question we ask every guest is, what is your favourite colour?
So our favourite colour is quite specific. It's called Helio Turquoise, and it's our favourite colouring in pencil, which we used a lot in the sleepers, and we use it in all our drawings. And it's quite funny because like Helio Turquoise is like the most revered colouring in pencil for us. And when you're in Barcelona, like working in your studio in like the suburbs a million miles away from an art shop, it's like these colouring in pencils become really important. And we found ourselves kind of like fighting over who got to use it and for what bits. And it's,
even though we're working on the same drawing, it was no, I need it.
It's a very like charged pencil.
But we use it as a substitute for black. So we don't ever use black in the coloured pencil drawings. Because it kind of like, I don't know, I feel like it kills the shadow. So you'd make the shadow up of Helio Turquoise and Red Violet, and then you'd start to get something close to black.
Interesting.
And I love the fact that the answer to both of these is, we like this.
I know, me too. Like, I was saying that. You have a joint answer.
Aligned.
Brilliant.
How long have you been together?
7 years.
Nearly 7 years.
Wow, congratulations. Yeah. Do you ever... What would happen? I mean, it's never going to happen. What do you ever have to have that discussion as artists making work together as a couple? What happens if one day something happens and you both can't do it anymore?
We just worry about one of us dying.
Oh my God.
I was like, if I die, you have to still sign all the work with my name.
Wow. I was like, that would be incredibly sad for me.
Yeah.
Yes. No. We're getting morbid.
It's not going to happen, guys.
No.
We're going to be alive working together
forever.
I
think we would always work together.
Yeah, I couldn't.
I don't know how people work,
honestly.
Not in a duo.
Thought of even doing something like this, like, it's obviously like you guys are super friendly, it's really nice, but imagine just being by yourself, you don't know what to expect, you can't talk about it with anyone. You have to be really brave. I don't know. I don't think I could do it. Or traveling. Or
I think you both seem really brave. As a couple,
I do as well. I think you're incredibly brave and incredibly
going up and down the country, going into these spaces and being told no, and you're like, actually, no, yes.
No, I think we both feel like we're absolute sort of shaky little cowards, but we do manage to put it on somehow.
Well,
I'm really grateful for your work because I think you're documenting what you are documenting. It's incredibly important that it has been recorded and also analysed and thought about. Mm. And I think it's really good to question, you know, like different communities and especially like the gay community and how we're all taking care of each other and the respect that we need to have for each other.
Mm.
You know, regardless of, you know, whatever you are, I think it's really important that we have that respect. And I feel like your work is, you know, analysing and criticising but also celebrating and but in a really respectful way that's very open, and it's got having an open conversation basically. And I've not really been that familiar with many artists. I mean, there's some people, I guess, Prem Sahib and you know, his work kind of made me think about similar issues, I guess. But I do really love what you guys are doing. I think it's really, really special.
It reminds me of David Wanarowicz, his sort of story, and you're like, and you just signed with PPOW Gallery in the States, who look over his archive, and Martin Wong's.
I've been reading his book. A friend of mine, Ben, just gave it to me and wrote me an incredible letter in the front of the book, asking me to read it and to focus and actually not just get distracted and not read
it. Incredible, isn't it?
And I've been researching a lot of his work this week, and that picture of the buffaloes.
I know.
Yeah, jumping off the cliff.
And I had no idea it was actually from like a museum kind of...
Like lemmings, they just...
Yeah, but it was like a museum installation where he was actually... Because I was like, how did he get on the side of that rock? You know, like, how was he there when they fell off? But then I realised actually... But it's such a poetic, incredibly profound way of talking about the AIDS crisis back in the 80s. I mean, it was... I think he's incredible.
Yeah.
And I'm just beginning reading his book, and I cannot wait.
Well, I think you guys are continuing the conversations that were being had then.
Oh, thank
you.
Yeah,
definitely.
Thank
you so much.
Love you so much.
Yay!
Looking forward to your frescoes as well. I cannot wait to see your frescoes.
Yeah, I know. Stay tight. They might be terrible.
I'm looking forward to see them too.
And we should do more interviews in the future. I think we should keep checking in.
It should be ongoing.
I would love that. Yeah.
Continue
so thank you
support.
So much. Yeah. We're going to post images of everything we've spoken about today on our Instagram at Talk Art, and we will be back very soon.
Thank you very much. Big
thanks
love.
For listening.
Thanks, guys.
Bye. Bye.
You've been listening to Talk Art with Robert Diamant and Russell Tovey. Follow us on Instagram at Talk Art, where you can view images of all artworks discussed in this episode. Subscribe to Talk Art at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Acast, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Want your most burning finance and investing questions answered? Here's a podcast you should be listening to. Courtesy of Acast Recommends.
Are you ready for some personality in your personal finances? Hi, I'm Janice Torres Rodriguez, Latina money expert and host of the award-winning podcast, Yo Quiero Dinero. On this show, we're serving up POC-friendly personal finance knowledge, always with a side of sass. We're not talking about avocado toast and lattes on this show. We've got real, relatable personal finance knowledge that makes you feel seen, heard, and finally understood. Consider me your super cool, slightly risque, but always honest financial fairy godmother. Together, we'll tackle dinero in a fresh new way so you can finally become poderosa with your dinero. Check out our weekly podcast episodes at YoQuieroDineroPodcast.com or subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.